Well, you guys heard this in the announcements this morning that this is going to be the last week for Sunday school for the summer, and then we'll resume in the fall. So, yeah, that's right. I like those boos. Good. Yeah, I heard Calvin was disappointed. We got a boo over here. That's yes, Charlie.
One reminder.
Yeah. Yeah.
Have you turned the recorder on
yet? I did. I just did. It's running. It's running here. Everyone is hearing me talk about pushing the button. So. So yes, want to remind you to sign up for the box lunch next week. So that we have enough lunches for everybody. The other thing is I'm making my last book recommendation for before the summer starts. This is important to me. It's so important to me that I actually read the last five chapters on Friday because I wanted to be able to actually recommend this book having completed all of it. And also because I actually really enjoyed this book. So they gave this book to me when I went to Twin Lakes. I don't even know if you all know that I went to a thing called Twin Lakes, actually.
Nobody has any idea what that is.
Nobody knows what that is. Twin Lakes is, I'm going to call it a pastor's conference, but it's more like a fellowship of men who are Presbyterians or Presbyterian Reformed, and we get invited to this by other guys who are like us, you know, just like-minded Reformed guys. And we're interested in confessional fidelity, and we're stodgy old grumpy Reformed guys. That's us. That's our thing. So when you go to this, they don't charge pastors to go. They let us go. And all we have to do is get there. And so I've been going now for 6 years, I think, 7 years. Anyway, they give us free books every year. And one of the free books they gave us was this one, and it's called What Happens When We Worship by Jonathan Cruz. Now, they usually put these books in our hands because they know that our churches are going to benefit from them, and they want us to consider the book. So I finished this book, and here's what I was thinking. I was thinking, we have enough people who are new to our church who I suspect have not been exposed to the sort of worship service that we do, the order of worship that we have. And I suspect for a lot of people, what we do in worship is very different than they're used to, right? If you're used to the lights coming down, the smoke machines coming on, a lone guitarist on the stage, and a spotlight shines on him as he shreds. And then, you know, all the... Listen, I've been to some churches, man. I used to live in Phoenix, and I saw everything. I saw a band get up and just perform a U2 concert, basically, for like 10 minutes before the service started. They just played a bunch of U2 songs. And I love U2, but I was like, what is happening in this church? They played Vertigo, which is like not one of their better known songs. It was like a deep cut. And I was like, what are you doing? So I've just seen everything. So what we do here for many people is mystifying. When I was reading this book, here's what I thought. I thought it's like he sat through one of our church services. It's like every chapter is just describing something we do. And so he gives a philosophy of worship. Why do we worship? What's the point of worshiping? And then he talks about the elements of worship. He talks about the call to worship. If you ever think to yourself, it's kind of funny that we have to have a call to worship, and that's when the worship is considered to start, then reading about that is really beneficial. After the call to worship, what do we have? We have an invocation. Why do we have an invocation? Well, he talks about why the invocation happens next. Why are we singing all of these songs? What's the point of singing? Why is singing something that's non-negotiable for Christians to do in worship? What is our philosophy of singing? He touches on it all. It's really wonderful. He talks a lot about the centrality of preaching. He talks about how on Sunday morning, when the preacher preaches, if he is preaching faithfully, it's Jesus that's preaching to the church. It's Jesus that's ministering his word to the church. So you just start combining all that stuff together. And I got to the end and I kept thinking he was going to say something weird. I kept thinking he was going to say something that was out of step with us, but the rest of the book's still good. And instead, what happened was I got to the end of the book and I said, this book basically describes what we do and is a fantastic way of explaining to people why we're not crazy. Well, actually, we might be crazy, but why we're crazy. Yes, Jake.
Instead of Sunday school, would you consider leading a book club that maybe we could do that in the summer?
In the summertime, like going through a book like this?
Can you repeat the question? pressure?
Oh, she said she was just asking in front of everybody under intense no pressure at all.
You caught me, didn't you?
Well, I did read it and highlight all the things in it. The one downside is I don't know what we would do with the kids during that time period. And
my kids like to worship.
I can read.
We've got some kids who could do it. Well, we'll have to think. I'm not opposed to it, but we'd have to think a little bit about how to pull that off. But in all seriousness, I've been wanting to, at some point we might even do, it might just be a good topic for Sunday school to just do a week at a time going through something like this too. That might be another angle to take on it. But anyway, I really can't recommend this book highly enough. It's called What Happens When We Worship by Jonathan Cruz. And the Cruz is not spelled like Tom Cruise. It's spelled without the I in it. It's like Tom Cruise without the I. So Jonathan Cruz, What Happens When We Worship, for those at home. If there's anyone on there. Is this thing going?
Are you sure it's not too stodgy?
It's not stodgy.
It's not stodgy.
No.
And then in that case, is it appropriate?
We can amend it for you.
Yeah.
Huh?
Yeah, I just described grumpy old Reformed guys. And he probably would fit that bill, but then he talks friendly. So I don't know. He's not, doesn't sound angry about reform. So maybe he's not trustworthy. Anyway, we could seriously consider other ways to benefit from something like this during the summer. I'm not opposed to it, but we'll just have to use some imagination there. So when we talk about the book of Joshua, I want us to situate Joshua in the larger picture of the history of Israel. So let's just go through the high points. And I'm going to use really rough numbers here as far as sort of moments in Israel's history. You have the year 2090 BC. These are all BC, of course. You have Abraham. Abraham or Abram. He goes to Canaan. That's 2090. Then you have the year 1876. It just sounds like a very recent date, but it's a very old date. 1876 BC, you have Jacob's family going to Egypt. So I'm just going to put Egypt. Then you have the 1400s. I'm using a rough date because I'm not exactly sure on the specifics. 1400s, you have the escape, the exodus from Egypt by Israel. You have the very wide period here. You have the 1400s to 1040, give or take. That's the time of the judges. So the book of Judges actually occupies a gigantic chunk of Israel's history. Sometimes we think of it as a short period. No, it's a very long period. Sadly, we're not going to get to Judges until September. Maybe later. Who knows? Whatever we decide to do when Sunday school resumes. But we'll get back to it. And so that's going to be what we do next. And then, you know, you have the United Monarchy. I'm going to say 1071... to 931, I think. Just make sure I write the right thing. You have Israel united under a king. Look at that short window of time when Israel is actually united under a king. Teeny tiny, just in the blink of an eye in world history, Israel actually is united as a single nation under one king, just living as one big wealthy society. This is the high point of Israel's life. But we're not there. In fact, we're not even here yet. We are just after the Exodus now. We are just in the period of time in which Israel is getting ready to go in. They haven't even possessed the land of Canaan yet. All they are is strangers and sojourners in the land, just traveling through. So anyway, I'm trying to situate for you where we probably are. I think I have a probable date for this book. Let me see what I wrote down. Well, these events take place in the 1400s, but I'm not getting more specific than that. When you're thinking of Israel's history, just think of 2000 BC as Abraham, think of 1000 BC as David, and think of 0 BC as Jesus. Or what would 0 be? AD or BC?
There is no 0.
Thank you.
1 BC is immediately followed by 1 AD.
Okay. So what was New Year's on the last year of BC?
Zero.
That's what I want to know. Okay. So we just went from 1 BC to 1 AD is what you're saying. All right. And even then, our counting is really messed up. Some monk screwed up, and our dates are all screwed up now. So we're going to talk, though, not about these guys. We're going to talk about Joshua today. And I'm going to move in a good clip, and I might even avoid some material. And the reason is because since there's not a next week, I can't be lazy and just let it all drift and just kind of talk, even though that's exactly what I'm doing right now. So Joshua the man. Who is Joshua? Joshua is a man whose name means Yahweh saves. Who else has the name of Joshua that's really significant in the Bible? Jesus. All right, yeah. Jesus' name means Yahweh saves. Great name. Good name. We already meet Joshua in Exodus 17. I believe Exodus 17 is the first time we meet Joshua in the Bible. He leads an army against the Amalekites, and because of Moses' intercession, he succeeds. That's where we meet Joshua. Not a bad way, really, to be introduced to the man. Along with Caleb, he was one of only two adults who lived to enter Canaan. There's another important piece of information to learn about Joshua. He was chosen by God to take Moses' place. This happens in Numbers 27:12. The ordination of Joshua is really significant in one sense because Moses lays hands on Joshua. He commissions him for the work of basically taking over Moses' prophetic office. And then the text tells us in another passage that I didn't write the reference down for, that he received the Holy Spirit in the laying on of hands by Moses. And so Joshua is able to do the task that he's called to because Moses lays hands on him. So Moses is sort of giving responsibility for his office. I'm thinking through right now my own philosophy of ordination and what laying on of hands means. And I think in its raw form, laying on of hands means transference of responsibility. I think that's why you lay hands on the scapegoat and why the priest lays his hands on the scapegoat, why he's laying the responsibility for his sin upon the goat and then sending him off into the wilderness. And I think that's what's happening here with Joshua. Moses is laying hands on Joshua and he is giving Joshua the responsibility. And along with the calling and the responsibility, God grants him the Holy Spirit so he can fulfill the task that he's given. That happens in Numbers 27:18. He also is somebody who meets the Lord. He meets the Lord face to face. Does anyone remember where Joshua meets the Lord? Yeah, on the road to Jericho, he is met by the commander of the Lord's army. And when he encounters this man, much like when Moses encounters the burning bush, what does Moses do? He takes his shoes off because the place he's standing is holy ground. And then in this moment when he meets the commander of God's armies, what does he do? He takes his shoes off. He takes his sandals off. And what you have in the ancient Near East is this practice of taking off your sandals to show respect. There is a vulnerability in removing your sandals. My wife and I were out on the dock, on the dock of our backyard, on the patio, and she could not take her shoes off because the ground was so hot. And so she had to hop back into her shoes when she thought she didn't have to. And if you've ever walked in hot sand, you know the great value of wearing sandals. You go to a beach, even when it's kind of cool, if the sun's been beating down on it, it's quite a dangerous thing to take your sandals off. You don't want to do that very often. And there is something vulnerable about removing your sandals, right? Suddenly, you're vulnerable. Sometimes you can be hurt by it. Sometimes you're not as able to run and take off. There's just a difference in posture that happens when you lose your sandals. I was thinking about this issue of taking your shoes off. Jerome says this. I like going to church fathers as much as I can. I like drawing from them more than new guys, not because I have a problem with new guys, but because I like going further back as much as I can and showing for you as a congregation that we have our roots further back than just the Reformation, which I love the Reformation. But Jerome says this, as long as we are walking through the wilderness, it is necessary that we wear sandals to cover and protect our feet. But when we shall have entered the land of promise, we shall hear with Jesus, Joshua, the son of Nave, the son of Nun, remove your sandals from your feet, for the place upon which you are standing is holy. When therefore we enter into the kingdom of heaven, we shall have no need of sandals or for protection against this world. But to give you a new thought, we shall follow the Lamb that has been slain for us. I like that they do a lot of typology type stuff. I enjoy it. I appreciate it. Joshua. We're still talking about Joshua, though. He met the Lord. He removed his sandals like Moses. He oversaw two covenant renewals in chapter 8. They read the curses and the blessings on Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim. And then in chapter 24, about 30 years later, just before Joshua dies, they have a covenant renewal ceremony. So this is something that's needed for God's people. But Joshua made one really serious mistake in his life and his ministry. Does anyone remember what the big mistake that he made was? The Hivites come to Joshua and they pretend to be somebody from very far away. And he doesn't go to the Lord. He doesn't consult God. This is in chapter 9 of Joshua. And as a result, he falls for their deception. So the Hivites end up having sort of they've sort of got their niche in the land. And by then, they're sort of bound to protect the Hivites now and allow them to live there. So, of course, these problems end up manifesting even more. When we get to Judges, you'll see that the big thorn in the side of Israel is these people that keep sticking around and didn't get removed from the land. So that's one thing that we also remember Joshua for, perhaps. Sorry, Joshua, you are with us, thorns and all. We do not know the authorship of Joshua. You don't find New Testament people quoting Joshua and saying, so-and-so said this in the book of Joshua. So we don't have any ideas on authorship. We do have an idea, though, that the author would have known some things about specifically this time period. You have, for example, a reference to Jerusalem being a Jebusite city. Jerusalem was a Jebusite city until about 1700 BC, or sorry, 1070 BC, when Moses conquers it. David conquers the city, it stops being a Jebusite city, but in this book, it's still being referenced as a Jebusite city. You could easily see somebody, if they're writing after David, just saying Jerusalem, you know. Instead, no, they're very careful to make sure you understand that this is a Jebusite city. All that to say that the book is written before 1000, I think there's a fair argument to be made that it's written before 1000, closer to the events when they take place. I'm going to move on, but I will say this. Remember that this is a book that surrounds the events of the conquest of the land. This is a book that tells us basically what happens when Israel goes in and starts, in essence, fighting the Canaanites. And there are some important letters. Has anyone ever heard of the Amarna letters before? The Amarna letters are these historical documents that actually talk about what was going on in Canaan at this time. This is a collection of letters that's written from the people in the land, that's the Canaanites, to Egypt. So remember, Canaan is under the protection of Egypt at this point. So they're almost like a protectorate. They're sort of if you're in big trouble, what do? You write to the Pharaoh. So the Amarna letters are the people in the Canaanites in the land writing to Egypt and saying, hey, we're having trouble. And specifically, they're having trouble with these people they call the Apiru. So the mayor of Jerusalem, I believe it was called Jebus at the time, the mayor of Jebus writes to Abdi Heba, the Pharaoh, and this is what he says. He says that he is at war with these Apiru. The Apiru is the word for the nomadic raiders. This would be a name for the Israelites. They would have been nomadic raiders to them. That's what they would have looked like to them. He says, now the Apiru have taken the very cities of the king. Not a single mayor remains to the king, my lord. All are lost. So we have this record that dates from around the 1400s where they're saying, hey, the Apiru are coming in. They're taking the land. Then you have this, the Merenepta Stela, which is another monument from Egypt that records these different victories that are taking place. Remember, they would have this Stela, which was basically like a big monument, and they would record on it all the victories that their pharaohs experienced. And the Merenepta Stela confirms for us that there was a group called the Israelites in Canaan at least before 1208 BC. So at least we have historical records of these things happening. It helps us to at least come up with a timeline as well. When did these things happen? This is a book that recounts Israel's partial conquest of the land. Remember, I say partial conquest because do they ever really remove the people from the land? No, I mean, the book of Judges is them living alongside of all of these people. And what do? They adapt to their ways. They become like the people of the land. God's constantly rescuing them from that. And then they get dragged back into it again. And all of that is a playing out of the consequences of what happens in Joshua. They do not totally remove the people from the land. And in the 400 years after this, they don't totally remove the people from the land either. So the time period, in other words, for this book is from the date of Moses' death to the date of Joshua's death. That's the book of Joshua. I'm not going to talk structure. If you really want my four-point outline of Joshua, I'll give it to you. But I'm zealous to try and stay on task here. I'm going to talk about the message of Joshua. The message of Joshua, one of the big messages of Joshua has to do with this issue. It has to do with the issue of land. This is geographic. There is this land that Israel's been given, and the question is, why is God giving the land? And he answers it in this book, in chapter 1. God says, because I swore to give their fathers this land. That's what motivates it. That's what describes. He does not say, Israel is doing this, I'm doing this for Israel because they've been so much more righteous than anybody else. They don't say there's something about these people that's just extra special. Instead, he says the only thing he appeals to is his prior promise. He says, I'm keeping my word, so I'm giving you this land. And where's the promise made? It's promise is made to Abraham, right? The promise gets made to Abraham. Here we are 600 years later, and he's keeping it. He's keeping that promise. I already mentioned this. I just have a note here. Make sure to highlight they never really possess the land. They really don't ever really possess the land. They're able to get a foothold. They're able to portion out territory for different groups. But nobody's able to say, yes, we have all the land. No other people are here. The Canaanites stick. I want to mention Achan and the Battle of Ai. Does anyone remember Achan? So chapter 7, chapter 8, Israel goes into battle and they lose at the Battle of Ai. And Joshua goes to God and he asks what happens, and God directs him to Achan. What did Achan do? Anybody remember? He plundered, he stole a cloak, he stole 200 shekels of silver, he stole a bar of gold. That's a big deal. And he hid them in his tent instead of devoting them to destruction, which was the command. One man disobeys, everybody suffers. And that is very counterintuitive to people, right? We have this instinctive individualism baked into our American mindset, right? We have trouble thinking of people in terms of communities. Everybody's a cowboy, right? Everybody's John Wayne. Everybody is sort of off on his own, doing his own thing. We're all lone rangers in America. And you read this and you go, I don't know what's going on, but it looks very unfair. That's usually our impulse because that's our mentality. What is the response that Israel has to the sin of Achan? Israel stones Achan and his whole family. Not just Achan, but his family. So one of the ideas here that really comes out, or at least that's baked into the fact that his family also end up facing the responsibility of what he's done, is this idea of federal headship. This idea that a family can have a head at all. And Achan here is meant to be head for his family, and his whole family suffers as a consequence. And then here's what happens. You get to the end of the story, and Israel is blessed because this man was disciplined. So the message here is God doesn't just deal with individuals. He deals with families. He has one individual to represent other individuals. I think the same complaint that it's not fair what happens to Achan and his family is the same complaint that people have about original sin. Like, we instinctively have this sense that I'm not in Adam. I didn't do that. I didn't take the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Why do I suffer for it? And there are a lot of people very resentful because of original sin, and they think it's all one other person's fault. And we fail to realize this was us. This was us. He was us. He did what we would have done. What we experience in original sin is not some injustice that's foisted upon us, but instead this is the way that God has constituted the universe, that we are connected to each other. I don't think that's a Karl Marx thing. I think that's just a God thing. That's the way he's planned for it to be. That's why Achan and his whole family suffer, because of what goes on here. If we permit and condone sin, we're liable to be judged for it. I think that's one application you can make from this. By the way, it is a blessing that God deals federally with us, because when I say federally, I mean as far as headship goes, right? If you read Romans chapter 5, you find out that this has its upsides and it has its downsides, but the upside is greater. Because the downside of federal headship is, yes, we're in Adam. We're in this sinner, and his sin is reckoned to us as sin. And so we experience corruption because of that. All of these things are real issues. I hope the sound's working. This thing looks funny. Okay, I think they can hear me now. Sorry, I get distracted. Squirrel! Here's the benefit of federal headship. We get the blessings of Jesus, because we get to have him as our representative. Paul says in Romans 5, you get to choose who your head is. You actually get a choice. And your choice is, are you going to have Jesus as your head, or are you going to have Adam as your head? If you're going to have Adam as your head, then you're in sin. And if you're going to have Jesus as your head, then you've been redeemed. And he says it's 100% fair, because either head is, it's something that's set before you. That's not a comment on election or anything like that. It's just personal responsibility. We have a responsibility to believe. We have a responsibility to put our faith in Jesus. Briefly, I also want to touch on, I don't have time to do it. You have this command to devote them to destruction. This, you know, when I think, was it Michael, were you the one asked me last week about the slavery in the Old Testament? You know, nice softball questions. Here's a nice softball. Deuteronomy 20, 16 to 17. But in the cities of these peoples that the Lord your God is giving you for an inheritance, you shall save alive nothing that breathes, but you shall devote them to complete destruction. The Hivites and the Amorites, the Canaanites and the Perizzites, the Hivites and the Jebusites, as the Lord your God has commanded. Well, so much for the Hivites. You got to mark them off the list now. They were supposed to remove them, but they tricked their way in. This is a hard command for us to reckon with, I think, as modern Americans. Right? We believe in the Geneva Convention. We signed the Geneva Convention. We want to be treated humanely by other people. And so we have these very modern sensibilities when it comes to ancient warfare. And, you know, our tendency is toward individualism. So we have trouble understanding the notion of a group being guilty of anything. In our minds, a society really is just a collection of individuals. And yet God looks and he sees the Canaanites, and they're all different people groups. But at the end of the day, he looks at them and says, these people have all transgressed my holiness. Even the little ones are corporately reckoned as being where their parents are. Right? We're used to this in the church, right? This is why we baptize children, because if your parents are believers, then you're holy. That's what Paul says. And so we already practice this in the New Testament. That's why when children are baptized in our churches, they don't become covenant children when they get baptized. They're baptized because they're already covenant children. They're already part of the covenant to begin with. All the baptism is doing is formalizing something that we already know is true. And same thing goes. I mean, this is a society full of people whose children have, you might think of it as a reverse baptism. They are part of a people, but they are not God's people that they're part of. Now, again, very hard for us to still square. We have so many notions that sort of undergird how we think about human rights and how others should be treated. I would just say, let's relativize this a little bit. That usually doesn't sound like something good for a preacher to say, but let me relativize this just for a moment, and let's ask the question, did the ancient people think they were being mistreated when they were being treated this way? I'm going to point you to a moment in the book of Judges. In Judges chapter 3, the Israelites catch this guy named Adonai Bezek. And Adonai Bezek is quite a character. Adonai Bezek, they catch this guy, and it says they cut off his thumbs and toes, and he ate like a dog under the table. Now, I can't pretend that I have read all of the Geneva Convention. And I might have missed a section about cutting a guy's toes and thumbs off and making him eat like a dog under a table. But if you listen to Adonai Bezek, he makes a comment about what happens to him. And the point that he makes is he basically says, this is ironic because every king I ever conquered, I did this to. And Adonai Bezek recognizes that he's getting what he deserves in the way he's being treated, right? It's called reciprocity. What you get is what you deserve. And he says, I'm getting justice right now. He's under the table. He's eating like a dog. And he says, I deserve this. You know, today I think a lot of people want to talk about how terrible Israel was for doing this. But by the standards of their own day, even King Adonai Bezek says, yes, I deserve this. Now, did I just solve every ethical quandary that this all creates? No. No. But what I'm trying to do is basically say we are so blinded by our modern sensibilities and by our own sense of how a gentleman conducts warfare that I think we struggle. I think we struggle with this sort of thing. So all I'm trying to do is sort of lay some groundwork for how we might think about this going forward. But I'm not solving every problem here. I think it was it Meredith Klein who said, this is a moment of divine intrusion where God takes the final judgment and brings it forward and gives these people what they already deserve early, basically. Anyway, there's other things that need to be thought through there. We can talk afterwards. But I forge forward because we will finish Joshua. There's another statement that gets made. This is really important. Joshua tells the people, you cannot keep the covenant. This is so interesting to me. Joshua 24, he's telling the people, hey, you need to keep the covenant. And the people said, we will keep the covenant. And he goes, you can't. Like, that is such a... That's called letting the air out of the room, you know? Like, here these people are like, we can do it. And he says, no, you cannot. He says, you are not able to do all that the Lord commands, for he is a holy God. Four. So there's the reason why. Why can't you do it? Because God's standard is higher than yours. God is greater than you picture him to be. And you think you can live up to him because you've made God small. And Joshua says, you can't because you don't know God. If you knew God, you'd be far more discouraged and you wouldn't be feeling so great about yourselves right now in this moment, Israel. His words are prophetic, by the way. You read the book of Judges and you're like, wow, Joshua knew what he was talking about. Look at this disappointing book. By the way, I'd like to preach through Judges here sometime. It is such an exciting book. It's crazy. It's a crazy book, but there is like not a dull moment in the whole book of Judges. Like, I went through Judges with my kids and Amos was like, that's my favorite book now. Yes. And for like years you ask him, what's your favorite book of the Bible? He'd say Judges. And you're like, what? Your dad must be one of those cranky Presbyterians that he would get you excited about this book. hyping the next lesson, but we're not there yet. What do we learn about God in this book? What do we learn about God in the book of Judges? One of the things we learned is that God keeps his promises, right? He promised them land. He gave them land. They all end up with a home. They have a place to stay. They have a place that's given to them by God. Now, they don't possess it fully. They don't possess it the way that they need to, but they have it. It's like a taste of the Christian life, right? We have the land. We have Christ. We have rescue. It is here. And yet we still sin. And yes, our life is still peppered with disappointments. And yes, sickness still besets us. And yet struggles still beset us. We're very much like we can reflect a lot on what it's like to be Israel living in the land and still have sin all around you. We relate to this. So what's the theme of the book? I might have actually been going so fast, we might actually be done early. We'll see. I used to say this to the college class, and they got so excited. And then at the end, I'd go, do you have any questions? And they'd be like, just looking around the room like, anyone says anything, he gets it. Yes, we want to leave 10 minutes early. That's kind of what it was like. I always thought, this is a bad thing to do. Yes?
Do
John.
Did Israel ever possess the entire geographic territory that God promised ever? The entire promised land in the boundaries that he depicted for you?
It depends on possession. If you mean with the enemies removed, yeah. No. The enemies are never completely gone. Israel is always sort of the story of the wheat and the tares. You know, I've used the illustration before of like when I was a kid, one of the jobs that I had before I could actually get a job was I would go and pull rye in the fields. Has anyone ever pulled rye? This is Kansas. These are Kansas problems. But like we'd go out in the field and my job was to pull up the rye. So you'd go out in the field and you'd have wheat and you could always see the rye because the rye is taller than the wheat. And so you'd go out in the field and you make sure you pull it up by the root and you'd just throw it to the edge of the field, which is really hard if there's a huge patch of rye in the middle of a field because you got to haul all of it to the edge of the field and throw it out. And, you know, because what happens? They go in, they harvest this stuff, and then they get bad yields on their wheat because there's all this rye mixed in. So you got to remove it. And Israel's like that, right? They are the wheat with all the tares. They've got all this rye mixed in. It's just a mess. And that's kind of the life of Israel. They have the land, but they're beset by trouble on every side. Yeah, it's wheat and tares. Yeah, Jeff.
Yeah, so I'm ignorant question, I guess.
Yeah.
Now, it's completely from memory, but I thought that in one place, the land promised Abraham went from the Mediterranean all the way to the Euphrates.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right? And if so, they didn't need the to occupy the land. So, I mean, I don't know if even the question is valid, but I was always under the impression that they never came close to occupying all the land that God promised.
I will look and see.
All right.
I will not try to answer in front of everybody. But the theme of this book really is, I think, Israel and the land, right? But there's also this other idea of rest. Rest is something that comes up quite a bit in the book. In Joshua, rest is something that is needed, but it's not the goal. It's this thing that's needed so that obedience can happen. Rest is the means to obedience in the book of Joshua, not the goal. So you have this passage like Joshua 1:13. They're speaking to the Reubenites and the Gadites, and Joshua says this, "The Lord your God is providing you a place of rest and will give you the land." In other words, rest comes first. Rest is given before they're obedient. He gives you rest. He's taking you to a place of rest so that you can have the land. The land is given so that they can be obedient. There's something about this that I don't want to make too much of, but I also don't want us to make too little of it. We can do make one or the other error. You have human religion, right? And human religion says, be good, be obedient, say a prayer, do a ceremony, offer a gift, live a good life. And then maybe once you've made yourself acceptable, God will accept you and God will give you rest. So you get the rest at the end of a good life, right? Does anyone remember Saving Private Ryan? I don't know if I already mentioned this before, but that moment at the end where he says, earn this. And then he dies. And you're like, Captain Miller, you're a jerk. Because you just saved this man's life and then told him for the rest of his life, he has to live in a way that he deserves to be saved by you. And just burdens him with this, be a good man, do what's right. Human religion, right? God will accept you. And then at the end, you'll get to rest. And God offers Israel rest first. He gives them the land first. He takes them into the land. And then he says that he will give you the land after you've been given the rest. So God calls us to live like this too. This is the way the gospel works. God gives us rest in Christ. And then he says, now I call you to live this out. Got 5 minutes left. Time for questions. Yes, Micah.
It strikes me that we are not all that different from Israel under Joshua in the land. They're given the command to go and commit genocide, take the land. And they didn't seem to actually have any problem with being willing to commit genocide. But they had issues trusting and pulling it out. And in fact, later on, they said, oh, but they got all these iron chariots, so we can't take the land, we can't do this. They had trouble trusting God, who they had seen work miraculously again and again and again. God had given them what they needed, but they failed to trust. And we can take something and read God telling them to annihilate the people of the land, and I can have trouble trusting that God, what God had said was good, what God had said was right, and what God had said was necessary. And so, in the same way that they are marked by a lack of faith, it's easy for me to read through what takes place in Joshua and be marked by that same lack of faith. And it brings destruction to them, which you see play out again and again in Judges. And you see that in men who have started off strong, who struggle with something like those texts in Joshua. They struggle to trust the Lord. And then you see it just make shipwreck of all everything. That's the danger present before all of us. When you read something that we're not naturally comfortable with, called to faith and trust in our God, it's not a different place than he's called people for millennia.
Yeah, and it's also worth mentioning, too, that this is a specific command he gives to a specific people in a specific time and in a specific place. He's not blessing the Crusades here. He's not telling us to kill our neighbors. this is something that was necessary in that specific time. And it's important that we not try to extrapolate out from, well, this is how I'm supposed to love my neighbor now. You know, no, that's not at all. So, yeah, John.
Was there a lack of faith displayed by the fact that you didn't follow God's command of wiping everybody out? They lacked faith because they didn't obey. Is that what you're saying?
Well, yeah, and they fear in the midst of it.
Okay.
Right? And so because of their fear, they refuse.
Well, and also remember what they're doing too. They're not devoting everything to destruction, which they're supposed to. So there's greed mixed in. There is a lot of motivations. We maybe read this and go, oh, maybe they just instinctively knew this just isn't right or something like that. No, what they have is sort of what Achan did, right? Achan's like, I love gold. Gold is good. I like gold. I don't want to throw this bar of gold away. Can you imagine all the good things I would do with this bar of gold once we possess the land? And all of this is stuff that he's motivated by, not by godliness, not by kindness or love. He's motivated by greed. Yeah, Calvin.
As you were saying, I just hear this echo in my head of what Paul said in Romans chapter 7. When I would do good, it's amazing. When I would do good, sin is right there with me. It wants to be part of that. And it's just interesting to see the story unfold. That while they've been given a command, an imperative, to take people out, take out these ancient tribes, and they fail to do it, it's their sin that besets them. Something about this commentary about our own nature.
It's their own sin that keeps these people in the land, that they refuse to remove them. And so don't think of it as a people group bothering them. It really is their own sin sticking with them throughout the years of the judges and through the rest of the history of Israel. The presence of the Canaanites still in the land 1,000 years later is their own sin being present. It is their own sin just given expression, given new expression again. Yeah, Jeff.
This might help, or if I see this rightly. The thing that always was indicative of me of what their, you know, the problem was, is that they would, instead of worshiping the one true God, they would worship these idols that were part of the culture there. And then instead of being a distinct people, they wanted to be like those around them. And I see we all have that same problem. We want to meld our religion with the common culture instead of being obedient, being peculiar. I kind of saw that they just didn't want to be that different from the cool kids.
And then I would also just draw one more. I would draw one more conclusion if I could do a. You know, sometimes I do this in sermons. I know this is Sunday school. It's different. It's very different. But If I could bring it around to Christ again, though, what are they called to do with the people of the land, the Canaanites? They're called to devote them to total destruction. And that is something that Christ knows a thing or two about, right? Christ knows what total abandonment is. Christ knows what it is to face the fullness of God's wrath. Even the Canaanites don't know what it's like to face the fullness of God's wrath, at least in their time in the land, because they're always being spared to one degree or another. What happens with Christ on the cross? Christ is not spared. God shows no mercy to him. He pours out his wrath in its fullness, does not relent, does not lift his thumb even a little bit. Instead, he gets everything. Jesus knows what it is to be devoted to full destruction in a way that even the Canaanites don't find out. Even the Canaanites, if you really think about it, are receiving mercy, even in how they're being treated in the land. As hard as that is to believe, but see, to believe that, we also have to believe badly of ourselves, which is right. We should believe badly of ourselves. And we should believe that we deserve full destruction. And then suddenly when we look at this, we think, you know, the Canaanites actually get it easy compared to what I deserve. It might be a starting place to reflect on that. Sadly, I'll talk to you guys after the service. After I'm going to pray, and because I know there's Sunday school teachers over there, and it's 12:15, but I'll stick around and visit. So we'll stick around and talk still. Let's pray. Father in heaven, we thank you for the grace that you show us in Jesus, who was devoted to destruction for our sake. I pray that you would give us rest in Jesus, and then I pray that you would give us obedient lives. Would you do these things for us? We ask in Jesus' name. Amen.